Hello and welcome to the Mejlis Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Pannier, host of the Mejlis and author of the Central Asian Focus newsletter. The European Union has had good ties with Central Asia for many years, but that relationship has been noticeably strengthening lately. In early 2024, the EU announced 10 billion euros for projects in Central Asia as part of the EU's Global Gateway Strategy. March and April this year saw a flurry of visits from top EU officials to Central Asia and culminated with the first ever EU Central Asian Summit held in Samarkand, Uzbekistan on April 4th. What are the areas of common interest between the EU and Central Asia, and what sort of partnerships have the two sides been forming in recent years? To discuss all this, I am joined by Terhi Hakala, a career diplomat from Finland, who is the EU Special Representative for Central Asia from 2021 until earlier this year, Samuel Dovary-Vesterby, Director of the European Neighborhood Council. Thank you both for joining me. And Samuel, I'd like to start with you. Could you tell me about these recent meetings and mention the Tashkent platform and what that's all about, if you would?
Yeah, so the context is, of course, that EU Central Asia relations have become far more important in recent years. And there's been really just an increase in meetings and in interaction and funding and diplomatic activity. And one can argue that that has kind of culminated with the presidential summit, which took place a few weeks ago. Summit meaning having both the president of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, as well as the president of the council, Antonio Costas, together meeting with all the presidents, the five presidents of Central Asia. And so they met in Samarkand. And it was described, and I think it's fair to say that it was a historic summit. It was the first summit of this kind. It was the first summit in Central Asia. And the outcomes of that were quite substantial, both in terms of a second round of EBRD funding, as well as other things like a second investors forum. Maybe we'll talk about that a little bit later. But in a nutshell, there was also this Tashkent forum or platform, the think tank that I work for, the European Neighborhood Council, together with the International Institute for Central Asia, which is a Uzbek-based think tank that does that has its main priority regional integration. We together also signed MOUs in the weeks before the summit, and an important component of the follow-up will, of course, be government-to-government, but there's also the people-to-people and think-tank-to-think-tank engagement, as well as business-to-business engagement, which will be important as a follow-up. And that's very much where the Tashkent platform, as well as, of course, the economic forum later this year, will come into play.
Okay, thank you. And I want to get back to some of the stuff that's going to happen this year. But if I could back up just a little bit, I mentioned that last year, in early 2024, it's the first time that the EU announced they had this deal for 10 billion euros that they were going to give as part of their Global Gateway program. Could you tell me a little bit about, I mean, it was billed as going toward connectivity, but it was more than that. Can you talk about connectivity, though, and some of the other aspects of that first tranche of money?
So there's been two lines of funding which have come in the past few years. And the first one came as a result of the first investors forum, which was early last year. And a large component of that funding really went towards digitalization, and it went towards renewable energy, but it also very much went towards transport, logistics, and infrastructure. I mean, when thinking about the relationship between the EU and Central Asia, it's important to remember that there was lacking infrastructure, and still to some degree there is. And there was, so both connecting, let's say, Europe and Central Asia, there was simply lacking amounts of infrastructure, and there were too many bottlenecks in order to increase trade. And so that investors forum very much aimed towards supporting that. And then another component was also, of course, creating regional connectivity. So the Central Asian republics, the five Central Asian republics, have, you know, historically, meaning recent historically, so after the fall of Soviet Union until now, had a very low amount of intra-regional trade. And so the Investors Forum was also very much geared towards fostering infrastructure and development between the Central Asian countries as well.
Okay, thank you. Ambassador Akal, I'd like to pick up on that too. I mean, you were there when they were talking about improving connectivity. I mean, it proved to be incredibly fortuitous that this was something that was already being discussed, because as we know, the routes through Russia became much more complicated after February 2022. So could you talk to us about, well, your recollections of the conversations on connectivity and what was done and what they wanted to do to connect Europe and Central Asia more strongly?
Thank you for having me in this program, Bruce. And about connectivity, look, it has been a long, long discussion. I mean, already earlier in the relations between the Central Asians and Europe. But of course, it intensified heavily after the war, the Russian aggression towards Ukraine. So there was a clear need, of course, to create new corridors for logistical reasons. And of course, when we are planning to increase trade volumes, and as Samuel was mentioning, that we have to also improve the logistics and the infrastructure inside the region to boost intra-regional and trade. This was a long story, but I think that it really actually kicked off heavily after the Russian aggression towards Ukraine. And of course, this is part of the EU's global gateway policy and outreach also to Central Asia and further on.
Okay, thank you. And let me follow up here. In your engagements with the Central Asian officials, what do you think was there, or did you notice was their particular interest? Was there one topic or certain topics that they really wanted help from the EU or a partnership with the EU to see realized?
Well, there is, of course, as we know, that there is so-called middle corridor through Kazakhstan, from China through Kazakhstan, Caspian Sea, South Caucasus to Europe. So that is already existing. But as we know, that not all countries can benefit from that. So mainly, I mean, of course, depending on the state, let's take Tajikistan, for instance, they are quite far away from the middle corridor. So the discussion was that what's there for us? Mainly, and how can we improve? How can we get access to the middle corridor? And that's why the EU really is speaking about the Trans-Caspian corridor, not just the middle corridor, which is the kind of main part of it in current situation. But we have to tie the other countries to middle corridor and further on to improve the possibilities for all five Central Asians to have the corridor towards West and Europe. Of course, some of them prefer the southern corridor to be improved, but this has become much more complicated after the regime change in Afghanistan. But it's still in cards, of course, and countries like Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan see the benefit of it developing it further. But in the current situation, of course, it is much more complicated to implement than the East-West corridor.
Okay, thank you. Samuel, let me ask you about critical raw materials. I mean, this has become the big issue of the day. And Central Asia certainly has an abundance, and they're advertising this. Can you talk a little bit about the EU's discussions with the Central Asians about critical minerals?
Well, I think the context of the critical raw material discussion is in some ways China, because China has dominated, has essentially had an exclusive monopoly on critical raw materials for a long period of time. And in recent years, countries around the world have kind of woken up. And in Europe, there's been new policies which have been implemented or being implemented, which essentially don't allow for the sourcing of critical raw materials that are too focused on one country alone, which in a nutshell means that Europe is now trying to diversify its sourcing of critical raw materials from many different places around the world. And one of those places is Central Asia. And we mentioned the first Investors Forum, where the topics of priority were very much connectivity, logistics, digital, energy, and so forth. And now we have an announcement since the summit, by Ursula von der Leyen and Antonio Costa that there will be a second Investors Forum. And in that Investors Forum, it's very much understood that the new investments and the new work will be dedicated towards critical raw materials. Now, critical raw materials, for any listeners who are not aware, but I think by now people understand the importance of critical raw materials. But in a nutshell, critical raw materials are important because they're kind of important components of our supply chains, of how we produce goods, and especially how we produce goods, like, for example, certain types of defense equipment, or, for example, silicone within solar panels, or geranium or titanium or many other of these elements, which are important for everything from consumer goods all over towards kind of innovative technologies like batteries and as I mentioned before, renewable energy sources. And the three countries in Central Asia that have, you know, kind of done some quite significant seismic and geological studies on this, and who have come out and shown that they have a very substantial amount of critical raw materials, are Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan for the time being. And so in the previous investors forum, I believe it was the previous investors forum, or maybe a bit earlier than that, there were two MOUs signed between the EU and Uzbekistan, and the other one with Kazakhstan. And since then, there has really been a lot of business-to-business activity in that area, and European companies are working together with local companies and governments on both prospection and various types of business ventures linked to critical raw materials. And this new investors forum, as well as the summit and the newly pledged amounts of low interest loans from EBRD, are very much directed towards those types of critical raw material exploration, mining, and potentially processing as well. And here it's interesting, because in the past, for a long period of time, and mining is not a recent industry, it's a pretty old industry, and for a long period of time, mining has often been of the type that goes somewhere, mines it, takes away the bulk mineral, often, you know, surrounded by dirt and earth in large quantities, and then processes it elsewhere. And so what the European Union is trying to engage with Central Asia about is that not only will it be mined, but that there will also be some processing, and maybe even the kind of co-development of supply chains within the regions, which is the equivalent of saying co-industrialization. And so this I think is something quite unique when it comes to the European Union, because, for example, China and other countries that are also interested in mining and prospection of critical raw materials are not so advanced on this topic. And I think this is something that the Central Asian countries greatly appreciate with regards to the European Union, the fact that there is this potential of technology transfer, the fact that there are ESGs in the European Union that to some degree protect labor rights and also that protect environmental rights, which is an important component of mining, unless you want, you know, kind of trouble with your own populations because of ecological issues and so forth.
Thank you. And thank you for bringing that up too, because, and I'll mention here too, that Germany's Bergbau, for example, is going to spend $500 million on two plants, I think, for lithium production and processing too. Samuel, I know you got to go soon, but I want to get in one more question for you. The EU during this last conference, in fact, they had a separate session that was devoted to climate change. Now, I know renewable energy sources and climate change have been real high on the EU's agenda when it comes to Central Asia. Can you talk a little bit about that, please?
Yeah, well, in today's world, the EU, previously also the United States, and I have to admit also China, are three poles that are very interested in the development of renewable energy. One reason is, of course, that ecologically, it is the most sustainable option and by far the most important one for the preservation of our planet and us living on it. Another reason is also that it is a way of creating autonomous energy. For example, when we look at something like fossil fuels, apart from the fact that they're, you know, very polluting and bad for the environment and bad for our health, and sometimes they create, you know, risk of seismic shocks and earthquakes, you know, if you think about, for example, natural gas in the United States and fracking and elsewhere as well, it's been a huge problem for like drinking water and all these kind of topics of ecology. But beyond that, there's also the fact that dependence is a huge security concern today. I mean, the European Union, namely Germany, but most of the European Union, many of the European Union countries, Bulgaria and many others, were highly dependent on Russian gas for a very prolonged period of time. In the German case, it goes all the way back to the, I think, 1960s and the Ostpolitik and whatnot. But beyond that, I mean, we have learned, I think, a lesson, which is that, you know, being too dependent on energy from others can create a lot of problems. And so in that light, renewable energy in Central Asia is a very interesting development as well within that regard. And what we see is that one part of the renewable energy discussion in Central Asia is, of course, you take a country like Tajikistan, where the EU has supported heavily the Rogan Dam. There is a very, very high level of renewable energy potential linked to hydroelectricity, because I forget the percentage, but you know, something like 70, 80, maybe more percent of Tajikistan is mountainous and has a lot of water. And then you can apply the same thing to Kyrgyzstan as well, also a very water-rich country with a lot of undulation or a lot of mountains. And when it comes to Kazakhstan, very, very high potential country for both solar development because of its sheer size, right? Kazakhstan is so much bigger than Europe. It is massive. And what you need in order to have cost-effective solar panel development is that you need mass, or you need like space, essentially, because you need to have a lot of unused space where you can maximize the cost efficiency of solar panel square meterage. And so that's something that Kazakhstan has. I mean, Kazakhstan has a lot of steppe where it's not a problem to install solar panels, a little bit like a desert tech in the Sahara. And so that's something which is very, very interesting, not only for the European Union in terms of renewable energy development, but also for Kazakhstan and the whole region itself, because, of course, these are regions that have historically been trapped in a Soviet infrastructure for gas and oil. And as a result, I mean, we've seen the case with Kazakhstan on many occasions in which, you know, oil passing through Russia has been politicized and halted for political reasons, which essentially takes away the autonomous independence of Kazakhstan, which has been a huge problem for the country and its citizens. And so these are areas. There are also other areas which are interesting with regards to renewable energy, like hydrogen. Also Kazakhstan, you know, being located a literal country on the Caspian. And when you want to develop something like hydrogen, it's of course important to have access to water and also to have minimum access to electricity in order to make electrolysis, which is a very, very environmentally friendly method of renewable energy and very high efficiency. And apart from the initial cost of building, which is of course expensive, then afterwards it very much pays off on the longer term. So these are really some of the reasons why the region is so important, both for the region itself, in order to provide energy, of course, for the ecological standard, environmental standard, but also for potential industrial collaboration in the future in which all these kind of renewable energies can be used.
Okay, thanks. I know you got to go in a minute, but I just want to get a couple of comments on one more thing. What about the power transmission line, the green energy power transmission line, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Azerbaijan, and 1,000 megawatts of electricity to Europe? Any progress on that?
I unfortunately don't have enough information to go into the specifics of that project, but there are a lot of different priority projects ongoing, and there are the funds now for it, which means low interest loans, EBRD, as well as grants from the European Union. The countries themselves, especially Kazakhstan and Azerbaijan, have also been quite generous in adding their own funds and investing themselves, because they understand just how important this is. And they understand that the European Union is a sustainable long-term partner to stay. One thing that I've seen regularly over the last few years is that you'll have other companies from, for example, from China or elsewhere who are coming and who are investing. And they come and they have a lot of investment power and they're serious about it to start with. But then some of the projects get delayed and they dwindle and so forth. Whereas the European Union, this also applies for this electricity project, you know, the European Union has come with the opposite approach, which is they come in with less expectation, but actually they scale up and they're more reliable in the longer term.
Okay, thanks. Ambassador Hakala, I want to go to you because I want to talk about this renewable energy also. I mean, you would have been party to a lot of discussions on this. Samuel just pointed out that there is a difference between investments from different countries. Now, the EU, when they invest in renewable projects, they're more of a, first, to use an example, the Sangtuta 2, the hydropower plant in Tajikistan, the Russians invested in that, and Tajikistan hadn't been able to pay that back. So it's still majority owned by Russia. But the EU has a different policy as far as when it comes to building renewable projects. Can you talk a little bit about the EU's approach to building renewable energy sources in Central Asia? And what the, are they left, are the Central Asians left with a huge debt?
Well, I'm not an expert on the debts at this point, but the point is that, of course, we have been launching all these programs and projects for some years already, because we all know that, first of all, climate change hits Central Asia very hard, and they have the resources, as Samuel was saying, and this has not been used to the full potential. And you might remember that, of course, for instance, the Rogun Dam, which was mentioned here, was actually so much not supported in the beginning, I mean, for 20 years ago. But realizing the potential and realizing its impact and as a kind of renewable and clean energy. So all the financial institutions and then also EU has been involved in developing that and supporting that. We have also launched different projects from the EU side and also from the member state side. For instance, we have a Team Europe initiative on water, energy and climate, which is a kind of nexus type of thinking and trying to tie all these links together. And water is an aspect here, of course, very much because, I mean, water issues are high on the agenda altogether in the Central Asian cooperation. And I think this is clear that we have to kind of be in that sector heavily involved. And as was mentioned, that the Samarkand meeting, of course, brought quite good results in that respect, and the heavy investment package which was launched, it has quite a heavy package for hydrogen projects.
Okay, thank you. And a reminder, we're talking about ties between the European Union and Central Asia, and my guests are Samuel Dovary de Vesterby, Director of the European Neighborhood Council, and Terhi Hakala, a career diplomat from Finland who was the EU Special Representative for Central Asia from 2021 until earlier this year. Samuel, one more thing I wanted to ask you about the satellite connections. I see that you'd mentioned that they greatly increased satellite connections between Central Asia and the EU countries.
Yeah, this was always a part of the digitalization discussion, and there have been separate meetings about this. Within the context of the EU, there's been meetings with DGs that are dealing with digitalization and the potential of linking up satellites. And that's a discussion which has been ongoing, and especially Uzbekistan has been a country that's been particularly interested. There's been quite a lot of development on that. And then separately, some member states have also been engaging in this discussion with the Central Asian Republics, namely France. France is a country that has, let's say, more autonomous satellite and digital systems, and also a country that has kind of important companies with regards to digital equipment, satellite transmitter processes, and so forth. And so the fact that Emmanuel Macron, you know, had delegation visits both in Uzbekistan and also in Kazakhstan, several of them over the past few years. Of course, the headlines were mainly on the critical raw materials and especially on uranium. But the people who came with him, there were really diverse portfolios, and the topics of satellite connection were very important as well.
Okay, thank you. Let me get to one of the questions I really wanted to ask both of you. And I'll start with you, Ambassador Hakala. Did you notice a difference? You were in the EU Special Representative for Central Asia starting from 2021. Was there a noticeable difference in the Central Asians' engagement or the things they were asking for between the time you started and February 2022 when Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine and then after that? I mean, is there two separate periods, or what was the continuity, or what did you notice was a shift after Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine?
Yes, I mean, I would say that Russian aggression was kind of a game changer for the region also. And what I can say is that I think there were it was not too much different, but I would say that we intensified our cooperation. Central Asian countries actually realized that they need to diversify their foreign policies and partner countries, and EU was absolutely one of them. With Central Asia wanted to intensify its relationship as a region, and also all countries separately really wanted to to give a boost to our dialogue, our cooperation. So in that sense, I would say that it changed the situation. We were actively working on many issues. Also, the intra-regional cooperation in Central Asia improved. I think they realized that they need each other more. And this has led into many positive results, like the border treaty between Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan. So the region is stronger as a region in today's situation. Of course, I mean, some changes came also with the sanction regimes on Russia. So we had to add a new chapter to our cooperation, working on preventing of the sanction circumvention. But I mean, it has, I think, only strengthened the ties between Brussels and different capitals, because it has been a very, very positive dialogue also from that point of view. So more intensified and active cooperation really after 22.
Okay, thank you. Samo, same question for you. You've been also doing this for a while. What did you notice was different after February 2022?
Well, I attribute several things. I think exactly like it was mentioned by Ambassador Hakala, like the Russian war was a game changer. All of a sudden, the Central Asian countries realize this is a very aggressive northern neighbor that at any time can attack a country like Ukraine, an independent sovereign country. And of course, a country like Kazakhstan that shares a huge border and also has a very noticeable ethnic or Russian ethnic speaking minority within its own country, immediately saw this as a major threat. And in addition to that, you had, as was also mentioned before, the more or less closing down because of sanctions, or there are many reasons that led to this, but the closing down of the Northern Corridor, like, you know, and then on top of that, the opening of the Middle Corridor, which back then, the Trans-Caspian Corridor, which back then, you know, had a TEU container value of, I think back then, probably 15,000, maybe even less, 18,000, something around there. And that then has since then tripled, essentially. And so these things are hugely important. But there are also other things which should be taken into account. Like, for example, the European Union signed the Enhanced Partnership and Cooperation Agreement, the EPCA, with Kazakhstan already back in 2015. And it started being implemented, I think, in 2016. And this agreement has essentially made Kazakhstan used to have main trade partners as China and Russia. But because of this signing of the EPCA with the European Union, the European Union is now the major trade partner of Kazakhstan. So that's a huge change. And that is not negligible. And it's not entirely connected to the war in Ukraine. It is also connected to it, but it's also a separate thing because this agreement was already signed back in 2015. Then there is also the fact that we are in this new world order, you know, very much where, you know, China is regarded as the main enemy of the United States. And presumably the United States is regarded as main enemy in Beijing. And these Central Asian countries and their leaders are, of course, fully aware of this kind of danger of bifurcation. Do they have to choose? They don't really want to fall under the dominion of someone else. And that already happened once to them before. And I think there's definitely no, you know, sociocultural desire or even economic and a willingness to do that again. And so these countries intelligently are trying to diversify their portfolio in international relations, and they're trying to build a strong relationship with reliable partners, for example, like the European Union. And then I think it's also important to mention, of course, Turkey is a country which is very appreciated within the context of Central Asia. Like at the European Neighbor Council, we do a lot of studies, and we've done studies also with the European Commission, where we also looked at which countries were perceived most popularly in the region and so on. And Turkey ranks quite highly. And many of the Central Asian republics have kind of looked toward Turkey and seen a form of role model together with the EU as being potentially more autonomous and being able to make a more independent foreign policy where you don't need to be under the dominion of others and always follow others. So I think that's also something which is important to bear in mind. And then in recent years, very recently, the fact that the EU defense industry is now, you know, kind of a booming policy and kind of an important component of foreign affairs today. I also, again, think that the Central Asians also look towards Europe because all of a sudden the European Union, which used to be only an economic union, has now also increasingly transformed into a security union or is transforming into one. And that's also something which is seen as attractive.
Okay, thank you. And I'm kind of curious, since both of you have been dealing with Central Asians for a while, there was a time prior to Shavkat Mirziyoyev becoming the president of Uzbekistan, where it was really a fractious region. I mean, there was not much sense of unity out there. You've been dealing with the Central Asian states for a while. You meet in these formats where all five of the countries are together. Do you see them, among the five of them, becoming closer? And when they speak at these conferences, meetings, summits, does it sound more like one voice, or is there still some dissent among or disagreement among the five countries that you've noticed? Ambassador Hakala?
Thank you. Of course, I mean, there's always competition. I mean, take any neighborhood, take the Nordic countries, for instance, five of them, even if we are very close. Of course, you have always some issues. But in Central Asia, I must say that I was very happy to witness this new policy. And it actually, I've been involved in those kind of meetings with the leaders so that I can also comment on the body language. And it's like a family kind of business nowadays. They know each other very well. They meet very often. And I'm talking about the leaders. So there is a clear improvement in many ways. And absolutely, as you said, I think that President Mirziyoyev has been a driving force also in this respect, you know, to improve regional cooperation, as has, of course, President Tokayev and others done. But I mean, many, many problems have been overcome because the leaders can talk and agree. The leaders' meetings take place on a yearly basis, and this, in a way, sets the agenda for the regional cooperation for the following year. But this is not only on the leaders' level. I mean, they have now improved, all five countries, their cooperation on different levels, between ministries, between ministers, between civil servants, border guards, etc. So, I mean, it's kind of coming from top down all the time. Of course, there are hiccups and there are differences, but that's normal in all regions, as I said. So, but very happy to see this development lately.
Okay, thank you. Well, same question for you. And I might note at this point that I always thought it was interesting that in the age 20 years ago, when everyone was, most of the outside world was looking at Central Asia and referring to it as something of a region, the United States used to refer to it as the stands, right? Which I always objected to. But anyway, they would say the stands. The European Union was the first one to come up with a policy that distinguished that there was five different countries here that were all on different vectors. And now all of a sudden we're coming back to where there is actually some regional coherence there. So do you notice that? You notice this is a development in Central Asian. Is there a Central Asian voice when the EU talks to Central Asia?
So in my everyday work, working together with think tanks, universities, civil society, and so forth in Central Asia, I have noticed over the past years that there is a real increase in both the desire to work regionally and also the conceptualization that there is a lot in common. And also from a purely kind of energy efficiency, trade prosperity, security point of view, there is a huge and real potential in further integration. And I think that's perfectly understood. Not only understood, I think that's guided and very much pursued by the intellectuals and by the governments and some of the research centers that we work with as well. I mean, the example I can give is right before the summit, I was in Uzbekistan working with some of our partners there. And it's very clear that whenever even though it's an Uzbek organization, even though, you know, it's situated in Uzbekistan and so forth, and they, of course, think about Uzbekistan, what really marked me was that in our conversations, it was constantly, and we must think, how can we include Tajikistan in this? How can we think about Kazakhstan in that context? And not only on corridor politics, but on supply chains, on energy efficiency, on renewables. So I thought that was really positive and practical as well, and shows a real sense of regionalism. And then beyond the policy area and, let's say, the more top-down components, I also went to a football match in Tashkent. Kyrgyzstan was playing against Uzbekistan. It was one of the qualifying matches. And I went there with a good Uzbek friend of mine and his family. And what really struck me was that I was seeing not one, not two, but tens and tens of people who were wearing, like, you know, the traditional kalpak hat from Kyrgyzstan, and who were going over to others with an Uzbek flag and saying, "Can I hold your Uzbek flag with my kalpak hat and have a picture together?" And then they would exchange them. I thought, wow, like, you would never even get that in the European Union, that has, you know, had like decades and decades and decades of regional integration. People at football matches are not that kind. But there you could really see, and this is a purely natural, absolutely organic, bottom-up, real cultural integration sentiments among themselves, of sharing cultural heritage values, you know, whatever you call it, hats and flags and so forth. And I thought that was great.
Well, that's a wonderful story. Thank you. We're getting close to the end of the show, so I'm going to just throw out a question. But if I missed something that you want to speak about, then please use this opportunity and feel free to speak about that. But since both of you have been involved in EU Central Asian relations for a long time, where do you see the relationship going? What would you like to, what do you think is the next step in Central Asian European Union relations? Samuel, I'll start with you, and I'll give the ambassador the last word.
Well, I think there are several things which can be improved and can be built on. I think one component which is very important is indeed, you know, the kind of very practical business-to-business cooperation. So in the past few years, the infrastructure and logistics has been very much priority focus. And we've seen an increase, as I mentioned before, in trade volume, a huge increase in trade volume, in fact. And we've also seen a lot more kind of logistic connectivity overcoming a lot of the bottlenecks and so forth. And so that's a very successful development. But to build on that, in order not just to have Central Asia as a purely transit area for trade, meaning trade going from Asia to Europe and back, it is very important to focalize even more on critical raw material and the joint industrialization policy. So that means getting companies together. And this very much fits within the context of the Global Gateway policy, by the way, because it is very much about trying to get business together and developing sustainable business solutions in, for example, critical mining and also processing of those minerals into maybe not all the way into end user consumer goods, but at least part of the way. Part of the supply chain should stay in Central Asia. The renewable energy projects, whether it's hydrogen or hydroelectricity or solar, serve a huge purpose in of course, making those industrial outputs more cost effective. And so these are things which still need to be developed. But I think that the summit very much prioritizes that. And I can only imagine that much more will come, both in the Investors Forum, in the Economic Forum after the summer, and also just in kind of business-to-business ties and links between associations. So I that's what I both hope, but I also very much expect will happen. Then another thing which maybe is important to add as well is the people-to-people component. It is vital that things like visa facilitation, Erasmus budgets, which are under the EAC, EAC DG in the European Commission, that these are increased. There is no relationship that has booming trade and booming infrastructure and booming industrialization and whatnot without a strong people-to-people, think-tank-to-think-tank, civil society component that has to go in tandem. And it's equally important. You know, maybe someone here in the audience is from the business side of the world and thinking, wow, I don't care that much about it. I'm sure they don't, but like maybe they think to themselves, it's not my priority, university to university or people to people. Well, actually for ESGs and for business, it's very important Because in order to have successful business in Central Asia as a European company and as a joint partnership or whatever it may be, you need to have, of course, certification and minimum standards when it comes to environmental standards, social standards, labor standards, and so on. Central Asia is already quite in a positive place with some of these, you know, especially in the textile industry. There's been huge reforms over the past decade and a half. So that's very positive. But there's still a lot of work to be done. And that very much comes with people to people, think tank, university to university, and civil society development.
Great. Thank you. Ambassador, you get the last word. Where do you see EU Central Asian relations headed?
Pretty much on the same lines, Samuel. First of all, of course, I would like to see the connectivity project really to happen. It has been long overdue, and I really hope that the Trans-Caspian Transport Corridor with all its ingredients and details will be established. It's a long project, I know, but I mean, in any case, we are going towards it. And it will, of course, bring more economic ties, more people-to-people contacts, of course, but it also has other aspects, like really improving the business climate for the future, having European companies getting more interested in Central Asia, because there are a lot of opportunities, which actually Samuel has described very well here. So I'm sure that increasingly this will happen, but of course we need these links to be improved, and I hope, because European Union now means a real business with the connectivity, so we can really fully implement all those plans we have. The political dialogue is excellent, as we have been discussing, that we witnessed the Samarkand summit, so they cannot get higher, the political dialogues, but it's a really excellent development what we have witnessed here. Our relationship is active, it is very intensive, and never been better, I would say. But of course, one issue which is very important, it has been very close to my heart, is the cooperation in education. It's part of the people-to-people contacts, but education and educational cooperation should improve even more, because we are talking about future. We are talking about the future of young Central Asians. They are increasingly interested in coming to Europe to study, but of course, the opportunities are not there to that extent. There would be a desire to come. Yes, visa facilitation, absolutely, we need more Central Asians traveling in Europe and vice versa to get to know each other on that level. But also opportunities definitely for young people, for university cooperation and institutes for vocational training. That is an important aspect also in our cooperation for the future. And people-to-people contacts, I mean, well, we all know how wonderful region Central Asia is, what kind of opportunities it offers, you know, to normal tourists. And somehow, sometimes it has been a bit forgotten. Now, maybe in the years to come and with our improved contacts, I think this will also increase the contacts and opportunities to work together. So in many sectors, I see pragmatic improvement, and I hope that this can be implemented sooner than later. Political will is there, as we have seen from both sides and from all European member states. Some of us are doing more than the others, but I think as such, European Union is absolutely in Central Asia for a long time as a credible partner. And as was mentioned, we are already the biggest trading partner and investor, and it should only grow in the future.
Okay, absolutely fantastic. Thank you. So thank you, Ambassador Terhi Hakala. Thank you, Samuel Dovary-Vesterbai. I appreciate you being on the program. A big thank you to Emmy Karoli, our Medjlis podcast producer in Washington, D.C. And a reminder, you can subscribe to the Medjlis podcast or the Central Asia in Focus newsletter by visiting Radio for Europe, Radio Liberty's website at rfarl.org. Thanks, and we'll be back soon. Bye-bye.